This is it, what? Satoshi's pouring from the sky. Stack some chips up. No fear of missing out. I'd rather dip and flip. What? Now pump it up and double up is what we hit. What? 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 This is it, what? Satoshi's pouring from the sky. Stack some chips up. No fear of missing.
Hello, in this auspicious anniversary 2021 edition of the 21ism video block, I had the great pleasure to talk to Jim Epstein, the Reason TV digital videographer who has very recently released a four-part kind of documentary series about the history of the cypherpunk movement, which I absolutely loved. Hello, Jim. Great to be here with you. Where are you today?
I'm a New Yorker, although yet last night I arrived here in Cleveland. I'm at my mother-in-law's house in Cleveland. So Thank you for, mentioning my videos on your Twitter feed and whatnot. That's been really nice. And
I've really enjoyed them. I think they're brilliant. And I'd like to push more exposure. You know, I'd like to try and push them out there. I think they're a great sort of resource for people. I hope they continue to get a lot of eyes on them because it's a really important area, I think. Not much is known about it by most people. It is pretty complicated, but I thought you did an amazing job of just kind of laying it out. It was really good quality, great production values. I noticed that you wrote it, you kind of filmed it, you kind of shot it, you edited, you narrated, and you did the graphics, right?
That's why it took me so fucking long. Yeah. I did. Although, with the exception of occasionally you'll see a really good graphic go by, and that's my colleague whose name is Lex, who's like does graphics on another level. And whenever there are a few points in the film where it's like, I just couldn't, my skills were just not up to it. So I brought Lex in to help me in those points.
Yeah, no, there was some really beautiful kind of intro graphics, I think.
The intro is Lex. Yeah.
Really slick.
Yeah, we're doing a, Lex is a big Bitcoin person, and we're actually contemplating an op-ed series of video essays about Bitcoin. We're doing our first one now, I think.
That would be fantastic. I'm looking forward to being able to see that, and that would be great. It's like a four-part sort of series, right?
Yeah.
And each one is around 10 minutes or so. The last one's a little longer.
I think they range from like 17 to 10 to 9 or 10, yeah.
Yeah, and the title of the series is Cypherpunks Write Code, which is a great title.
The title Cypherpunks Write Code is sort of a beautiful summation of the philosophy of the cypherpunks, which is that technology is the driving force in human history. Technology is what changes things. Politics does not. And it was actually a line by authored by Eric Hughes, who's one of the cypherpunk co-founders and was a mathematician. Mm-hmm. Tim May, who's I think the most influential cypherpunk, certainly believed that at one point. Some cypherpunks were saying, "Hey, let's hand out CD copies of PGP. Let's kind of advocate and get involved." And May kind of was just never interested in that stuff. He was only interested in the technology itself.
May has a quote in, I think it's the last of the episodes that you do. And so when that question comes up about whether there are any regrets about unleashing this kind of power of cryptography to a wider world, and he says that he has no regrets because it is a technology and it's a tool and it was going to happen at any stage. So you've just got to let history kind of take its course, right?
That's right. Yeah. And he was I think I have a quote in there as well from Dean Tribble, who calls May kind of he's the shock jock of the cypherpunk movement. And in some ways that's apt because he liked to make statements that would really stick with people and would be very provocative. And that was true in that moment of my interview with him too, where he sort of said, I'm not morally responsible with what people do with this technology. It's inevitable. It's just, it's the technology. And, you know, he also would draw these historic parallels and say things like, well, you know, the telephone has been used for, you know, all sorts of, for drug deals and crime and so forth. You know, this is always true of technology, that it's always a mixed bag to some degree, and it's inevitable. So we may as well accept that.
Yeah, I thought that was extremely kind of powerful. And I guess that libertarianism isn't something that we have a lot of experience or understanding of in the UK. It seems to be, I don't know, it's just, it seemed to get taken out of our education. But I can see that this emphasis of yours is sort of running very strongly and so through your series.
That's right, yeah.
And it hinges on that. It hinges on there is no moral responsibility on the people who push this technology. But and so people will use it how they want to use it.
That's right. Yeah. Cool. I think the cyberpunks were mostly libertarians, or they didn't all start out libertarians, but a lot of them became more libertarian as time went on. But certainly the key figures early on, Hugh Daniel, Eric Hughes, Tim May, and John Gilmore, were all libertarian.
Is there any chance that you could kind of talk a little bit about each of the episodes and just kind of break down in some kind of brush strokes about what your themes and your intentions were, you know, why you split it up, et cetera?
The first episode is about the tension between, well, first of all, it's about sort of the early internet years. It sort of takes the viewer back to the late 1980s. And this is before the World Wide Web, and it's before the commercial internet. But yet there was this community in Silicon Valley primarily that sort of, they saw what was coming. Because what people often forget is even before the internet, there were these dial-up services like CompuServe, where you'd basically, you dial up from your computer through a modem to a server, and you know, you could interact with people. You could, you know, buy things from the electronic mall. You could chat in sort of in these Usenet groups. Mm-hmm. And these folks saw where this was headed, that we were going to be able to interact and trade on a global scale, and that the personal computer was just going to be this total game-changing technology. So I really wanted to kind of set the scene for that. And even at that time, the people who were involved with the movement sort of saw two paths, that either this is going to become this engine of freedom, or it's going to empower the mm-hmm. the kind of Orwellian state, the surveillance state. So I wanted to set that scene, but I also wanted to show that early on, there was this kind of difference of visions between two of these early visionaries, one of whom was Phil Salen, who was kind of the key figure in this one group called that was at one point dubbed the high-tech Hayekians, and then Tim May, who's the father of crypto anarchy.
Yeah.
And May was really interested in using technology to kind of build these like little gulches, which is a metaphor from Ayn Rand. It's sort of like a shielded world, a world shielded from encryption where government can't control us. And he was very interested, very influenced by Werner Vinge's novel, True Names, the idea that there could be this other world separate from the real world where we would be free. And this would be kind of, this was the main idea. This was the engine of freedom in this new technology. And then May, who was very, very influenced by the ideas of Hayek, his idea was that this technology is going to kind of just exploit all the gray areas in society. We're all going to use this technology to trade, to interact, to communicate, and little by little, just we're going to move towards a freer world. So it's this kind of this different paradigm. And you know, Salen was not just an intellectual; he was also an entrepreneur, and he built this very cool e-commerce startup, we're talking the late 80s, by the way, called
Amex,
the American Information Exchange, Amex.
Yes.
And it didn't work, but he had, it didn't end up taking off, and Salen died of cancer, tragically, before it really could. But it was, you know, it was really kind of in reaction to this idea, to Amex. It was in discussing Amex that May really started to formulate his ideas for what would serve as the roots of the cypherpunk movement. And I really think that this difference of opinion between May and Salen almost kind of set the course for the cypherpunk movement. And you still see that today in terms of in the cryptocurrency community, in terms of different philosophies about how this technology is going to impact society. Yeah, so the second episode really brings in the concept of public key cryptography, which predates Amex to some degree. You know, it was in the late 70s that they were. It was sort of mathematicians and cryptographers at Stanford at MIT who were kind of putting together this completely groundbreaking idea, which most people don't realize what kind of an impact this discovery had, which was the concept of public key cryptography, which meant that two people who didn't know each other could interact with each other in private without involving a third party, without transferring a key. And they could do it in a way that that a global superpower couldn't crack the code. And this was a complete transformation in the field of cryptography. Not a lot of people realized in the late 70s what had happened, although some of these early cypherpunks did. It wasn't actually until a little bit later that Tim May kind of caught on to cryptography, public key cryptography, as this really game-changing invention. And my second episode sort of explains the concept of public key cryptography and sort of its implications. I interviewed David Friedman, who had this metaphor where he called it like he compares it to the Second Amendment. That this is the technology that in the same way that in early America guns protected the individual from tyranny, this is a technology that protects us from tyranny. And that's an idea that actually goes all the way back in the cypherpunk movement. There's a great paper called From Cryptography to Crossbows, which was one of the first things posted to the cypherpunk list. And it draws that same analogy between encryption. Encryption is a tool that shifts the balance of power from this between the state and the individual. So that was part two. And then in part three, I got into what's commonly known as the crypto wars, which is really in the 1990s, when the battle between government and civil liberties activists really heated up about whether or not we would have the right to use encryption, whether individuals could have end-to-end encryption, whether companies could build end-to-end encryption into their products, because the government recognized how powerful this tool was. And they wanted to stop it. And frankly, they're still trying to stop it. The crypto wars never ended, but it really being fought in the 1990s. And it's thanks to people like John Gilmore, who's a co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and a cypherpunk, early cypherpunk, who just fought this absolutely brilliant legal and public relations battle to keep cryptography legal. And then the fourth part in my series sort of loops back to some degree to the themes in the first part, exploring kind of the different philosophies between the high-tech Hayekians and Tim May, getting into a little bit how one thing is I also kind of use the Berlin Wall as a metaphor in that episode as well. And just showing how there was so much optimism at that moment about that walls were going to come crashing down, and that public key cryptography could be extended to things like money. You know, these were the early attempts to create a sort of if it wasn't just about communicating cross borders, it wasn't just about knocking down political borders, that we were going to be able to trade freely with anyone around the world. And sort of, I think this really was important context for people to recognize that that's when the cypherpunk movement was starting in the early 90s, when there was this incredible optimism. So that's really the focus of my fourth year part. And I kind of bring it up to the invention of Bitcoin in 2008.
Yes. So it covers around sort of 20 to 30 years essentially before Bitcoin, right?
Right.
You started in the sort of late 60s or the early 70s or something, don't you?
I mean, it starts really in the late 70s with the first paper in 1976, which was when the first paper was published explaining the concept of public key. Diffie-Hellman's paper describing the concept of public key cryptography.
And so you had the opportunity to interview these people.
I interviewed May not that long before he passed away, actually. I did not get to interview Eric Hughes. I talked to him at length on the phone. He was willing to be interviewed. I didn't make it out to Utah, which is where he's located now. And I did interview John Gilmore. I interviewed Whit Diffie. Yeah, so I interviewed a lot of people. I was hoping to interview Nick Szabo, but he wasn't into it. I think Hughes and Szabo were the two people that I really wanted to talk to because I think they're pretty seminal figures in the cypherpunk movement.
And so Tim May seemed very well at the time in which you filmed him, but you said he sort of passed away quite soon afterwards.
He passed away. Yeah. I mean, I think he passed away pretty suddenly. I don't know all the details, but he was not ill for a long time. I had corresponded with him via email weeks before he died.
Right. Yeah. It was interesting to see him as an older man, this kind of crypto anarchist, as an older, quite comfortable and so quite relaxed, quite kind of chilled out sort of guy. You know, he's not quite kind of how I imagined him.
Yeah. Like, I wouldn't say that his ideas had softened with age.
No, you wouldn't.
I mean, no, he was still as radical as ever. Was as radical as ever. And to some degree, you know, the cypherpunk movement, you know, before Bitcoin, it sort of seemed like the cypherpunk movement had been a misdirection or it had been sort of a failure. I mean, most of the ideas, most of the things people talked about in the movement didn't really come to pass. There hadn't been a cryptography-based form of money. There was this sense that like privacy was disappearing. One person I did interview for my piece, whose name is Jim McCoy, who was an early cypherpunk and started Mojo Nation, which was kind of one of the most interesting cypherpunk projects. Jim McCoy ended up working for Facebook. It was kind of, which is sort of the opposite of a cypherpunk project. So in that sense, I think up until Bitcoin, it really seemed like, you know, it hadn't worked out exactly, but Bitcoin completely revived the movement. I mean, people know the term cypherpunk thanks to Bitcoin, and it kind of showed that, you know, maybe the cypherpunks were too early. They were way ahead of their time with these ideas, but now we're starting to see some of these ideas come to fruition.
Yeah, I think there's a big resurgence of interest in these ideas and the development of the history. And so you see all those big kind of graphs of the development of Bitcoin and the different attempts to crack digital money that went before it. And in a sense, I see your work as kind of overlaying that, but with the idea development and the cultural development and the legal precedents and kind of wars and discussions that went along with that development. It was great. And so it took you a long time to film and to put together.
It took me a long time in part because my main job is, for most of that time I was the managing editor. Now I'm the executive editor of our video platform at Reason. So I don't have a ton of time in my schedule to work on my own projects. When I started to get interested in the cypherpunks, what I started doing was whenever I would have a trip anywhere, whenever I'd be heading out to the West Coast, I would set up an interview. I would reach out and see if I could sit down with someone like Tin May. So that was like tacked on to another trip that I took. So I started just collecting these interviews in a way I wish I didn't have a strong focus at that point. I could have done better interviews if I'd known exactly where I was going. But then it was about, I don't know, maybe about a year ago that I decided, okay, let me start actually trying to craft this into something. I did shoot it over a long period of time. It definitely took me, I didn't go into it knowing exactly the story that I wanted to tell. I didn't meet Mark Miller and Dean Tribble and Chip Morningstar and these people who were part of this other group within the cypherpunk movement until after I interviewed John Gilmore and Tim May. So that came much later. It was definitely a long process.
And so this was a kind of personal project. not a project from Reason TV. It was
it was a Reason TV project.
It was a Reason TV
but it was project. Just kind of a project that I had kind of on the back burner for a long time, and it was just something that I was doing, a little kind of longer term project that I had going while I did a lot of other things.
And so Reason TV, and so would you be able to explain a bit about what that is, what the agenda of the network is?
Sure. I mean, we're kind of the video, we're the video journalism platform for Reason Magazine. And Reason Magazine is really the premier libertarian opinion journalism periodical. I mean, we were founded in 1968, and we've had a print magazine running since then. We write about politics and art and culture from a libertarian perspective. So it was actually Drew Carey who had the idea for Reason TV pretty early in this sort of online video world. He saw that online video was going to become this thing. And this is, we're talking about 2008. So it's pretty early. And so he started a channel, and he actually starred in a lot of our first videos. I came on board in 2010, I believe. And really since then, we've been producing, you know, every week we put out about three documentary projects. We do a whole different range of topics. We do, we've done a few feature documentaries. We do coverage of, all sorts of local, national issues from a libertarian perspective.
You have quite a lot of artistic kind of license within that. You, in terms of to set the agenda yourself, in terms of the sort of funding and things.
Oh, for sure. Well, yeah. I mean, we have journalistic independence, we tell stories. I mean, for example, today we put out a comedy video about Christmas ornaments at the White House. Tomorrow we're posting a piece about Ross Ulbricht, about why Trump should pardon Ross Ulbricht, which touches on Bitcoin, actually.
Awesome.
We posted a video about, which is kind of based on a new book, an interview we did about the importance of immigration for the country. So, it's a wonderful place to work. A lot of license to do things that are creative and to cover a wide range of topics from a libertarian perspective.
I explored some of the back sort of catalog on YouTube, and I thought it was very wide-ranging and a really good kind of quality, and also impressed that there were no kind of paywalls that were really evident either. So, I mean, it's open and free access to all this great content, which was amazing. Wow. It was your idea to do the series. It was your concept.
Yes, it was my idea to do something on the cypherpunks. What actually happened was, I don't know if you've heard of the writer, Paul Rosenberg. He did a video. Yeah, he's briefly appears in the series. I did interview him, and he's written a couple novels, and he's got a newsletter. And he did a little talk, I think, for like a Chicago Bitcoin meetup. And I noticed, I think his daughter might have posted it to Twitter. And I watched it, and I really it really piqued my interest in the cypherpunks. And realizing that so much of, by that point, I was already a bit of a Bitcoin fanatic, and realizing how the themes and sort of the things that people are talking about today have this antecedent that it was, people were talking about the same things, that there was this real history and that I didn't know about and that I didn't understand. So that kind of sent me down the rabbit hole to learn more about the cypherpunks. And there've been a few good books written that kind of go into the history. So that's kind of where I got the idea that I wanted to do something in video about this group, although I didn't quite know what yet. So that's when I set out and I started collecting interviews.
Great. And so you said that you were a Bitcoiner before this, of course.
I remember I first heard about Bitcoin when it might have been 2011. I'd have to look back at when this episode appeared, but there's a popular podcast I listen to called Econ Talk. Russ Roberts, the host, was interviewing Gavin Andreessen about Bitcoin. And I was listening to it, and I couldn't quite figure out what they were talking about. And then I finally got it. I was like, God, there's no way this is going to work. This sounds like a ludicrous idea to me. But it was somewhat interesting.
Yeah,
and I sort of forgot it for a few years. And then I think one of my colleagues at Reason did a short piece about Bitcoin, and I started to pay a little bit of attention. I don't quite remember what was sort of my sort of oh shit moment with Bitcoin, where I really, I think I was reading, I started to get a little more into it and read some papers and started to understand it a little bit better. And once I started to really grasp the concept, I was just absolutely hooked. I wanted to spend all my time, it's the same story you hear over and over again about people sort of have like this aha moment where they realize the implications of this thing. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of all they want to like think about or read about or talk about for a period of time, to the detriment of the people around them. So it was really, 2013, 2014, I started to get really, really interested in Bitcoin. And still to this day, I mean, I think of all the things I cover, it's the topic that interests me the most, because I think it has the most potential to change the world and to make for a freer world. And to a large extent, I agree with the basic cypherpunks write code philosophy, mm-hmm. that technology is the driving force of history and that there's mm-hmm. ultimately not much anyone can do about it. And politics will always disappoint.
Well, that seems to be the way of things at the moment, at least. And you talked about the battle for privacy and for encryption not ever ending. That seems to keep coming back again and again and again. There's a lot of legislation within kind of Europe right now to try and ban end-to-end encryption by technology companies to the public, which is just really terrifying, isn't it? I mean,
yeah. It is terrifying. And I think what the cypherpunks of the 90s during the crypto wars, sort of the theme they hit on is that encryption is free speech. It's software. Mm-hmm. It's just software. And if you can write PGP code in a book and sell it in a bookstore in London, as MIT Press did, and export it across borders. It's just words. It's a language, and that you can tattoo encryption code on your body. The government has no right to ban that, mm-hmm. to ban software. And I think that's ultimately the best tactic. And I really do think that ultimately the crypto wars are going to extend even more to Bitcoin at some point, because as Bitcoin grows and becomes more important and starts to replace fiat money, I think mm-hmm. that governments are going to do whatever they can to stop it. And they're going to find more reasons to outlaw it or regulate it or ban it. But ultimately, I don't think it's going to work. But I think that, the crypto wars are not just never ending, but, they're going to heat up. I don't think it's going to work to ban or outlaw Bitcoin. I don't think that can be done.
And so you've been creating films for some time now, right?
Right.
When did you start filmmaking?
So I started, I actually spent 8 years at the PBS station in New York City, which is called Channel 13 WNET. I worked on a local show there, kind of a local New York City documentary show for about 8 years. Uh-huh. Started there in, I guess it was, would have been 2002, and then worked there for about 8 years and then joined Reason in 2010. So I've been making short documentaries sort of since then for my whole career.
So you've had the privilege of kind of working in an artistic kind of creative space that's been able to pay your salary, which
thank God for the internet, right?
Thank God for the internet.
It's a great time to be a videographer. It's a great time. I mean, I my career, it's interesting, sort of I straddled the change, because when I was a producer for Channel 13, which was it was a network, it was a station on television. Mm. There wasn't really streaming video at that time. That happened over the course of my time there. It wasn't quite possible. We had like real player technology, which just didn't work very well. No one was really doing it. You would go in and you would edit in a big editing room with an editor. We did have these mini DV cameras, which were relatively cheap, by today's standards looked like crap, but that did sort of free the ability to go out for a producer to go out and shoot something with a camera that didn't cost a fortune. But you know, it's sort of, when I came to Reason, that was when I was really started working online, and it dawned on me instantly how much better it was. Just that, like, I remember the first video I posted to YouTube, people were suddenly commenting and reacting like immediately. And it's frightened me. It freaked me out, but it was sort of like wonderful. This idea that you were no longer shielded from your audience. You watch how the quality of video and storytelling and documentaries has improved with the internet, just by giving everybody the tools, by lowering these artificial barriers to entry that used to exist. It's been absolutely transformative for the media. I mean, the pace at which people are innovating in terms of the stories and the graphics and the formats is really just amazing. And it's been I feel very privileged to work in that world, and very privileged also to have seen a little bit of the old world earlier in my career, so that I can really appreciate how good we have it.
Great. And so, in broad kind of brushstrokes, again, could you sort of describe your process with making a short documentary? Say, if you were making a sort of 10-minute kind of episode of this one, how would you kind of plan it? How would you conceive it? How would you then shoot it? What tools would you use? The shooting process and the editing process?
Wow. Well, it's a little different with every project, I would say. It starts with an idea. It's often my last project which leads to the idea for my current project, which not always. So you have an idea. And then for me, since I'm a journalist and a reporter partially, you know, I start calling people, doing interviews, and just kind of figuring out what the reality is. And then through that process of writing questions, I begin to think about what the focus of my story is. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when you're making documentaries, you start to kind of gather the ingredients that you need in the form of interviews, in the form of footage out in the world, graphics, magazine covers. For example, with the Cypherpunks documentary, one thing I realized early on is like, what the hell am I getting myself into? This is a documentary about just like a bunch of smart guys sending emails to each other. Like there's no visuals. How could I possibly make a documentary about this topic? So then I had the idea, well, you know, archive.org has all these like great computer magazines from the 80s. So maybe I could lean on those. And, you know, so that was kind of an important ingredient, because the thing that a filmmaker always asks themselves is like, what am I going to put up on the screen while people are talking? That's always the big puzzle, and that's kind of what pushes you to be a little bit creative. So you're kind of just going out assembling the ingredients you need, and then you sit down at a computer and you assemble a paper script, you edit it, you try it out, you turn it, you put it into a timeline, you try out ideas in the timeline. Inevitably, it doesn't work. But then you go back and you fix it and you try again. It's a process. Basically, I think the process is of just constant revision, seeing things aren't working and then trying again and again and again. You need to have to really stick with it in order to get through it, because it's very frustrating at points before you have something that really gels and holds together. I mean, even with the Cypherpunks documentary, I tried it in different forms. At one point it was going to be a full length documentary, but then I thought, okay, well, maybe it works better as a series, but I kept moving things around and trying things differently. You have to be very patient and not give up.
Sure. And then when it comes to the shoots, and so what kind of cameras are you using?
We're transitioning a little bit now. The cameras we're using are Sony FS700s. I also increasingly actually use my iPhone when I shoot, because I love shooting with my iPhone. It's a great, great handheld camera in all sorts of situations. 4K, beautiful stabilization, beautiful imagery, incredible tool.
Interesting. And then when it comes to editing, and so what are you using?
I'm a Final Cut editor. I do After Effects and Final Cut X. Most of my colleagues use Adobe Premiere.
And so how long does the editing sort of process normally take, say, for a 10, 15 minute piece for you?
Oh boy. I mean, we put out videos that can just take a week beginning. And then there's some that take 6 months. I mean, it's yeah. totally, it's a very wide range.
You said that you're also planning another project in relation to Bitcoin.
You know, this is not essays I'm doing, but more just I'm overseeing in my role as editor. We're doing a project about, we're contemplating doing some op-ed essays about Bitcoin, graphic essays about Bitcoin. I want to get more Bitcoin into our channel. And, you know, our brilliant editor, graphic motion artist, motion graphic artist, Lex is really into the topic as well. So we're just kind of thinking about different people we can reach out to who could do video op-eds for us.
There's quite a lot of libertarians who have an interest in Bitcoin.
Oh, yeah, sure. I think it's, in the early days, it was only libertarians. Now the mainstream yeah. folks are catching on too. But yeah, it's pretty libertarian. I mean, Bitcoin Twitter is pretty libertarian. I think it's, you know, sure. it's libertarians who see the appeal of an alternative to state-issued money.
And so are you starting to use it more in your daily life, in your business, Reason TV? Has it integrated there yet at all?
Reason takes donations in Bitcoin. Reason has some yep. Bitcoin. I own a little bit of Bitcoin, not much, but I'm certainly someone who cares a lot and is fascinated by Bitcoin. And that was true even before the Cypherpunks documentary.
Yeah. Because the interest and excitement at the moment with the price activity, of course, is getting very heated. It's this incredible kind of conflagration of these two phenomena that, you know, the whole COVID year, the political chaos and the rebirth of Bitcoin. It's all seems very auspicious at the moment.
I agree. It's pretty exciting.
Do you have any expectations for the future, for the next year?
I don't know. I'm pretty bullish. I think the price will keep going up. And I think people maybe will get into it as an investment vehicle, not totally understanding its implications. But I think that's okay, because when people buy into Bitcoin, the network grows stronger and new people discover it. And, you know, new people who will become core developers or who will build things that use it in interesting ways, or people who are activists or dissidents and living under repressive regimes will discover its utility. So yeah, I'm incredibly optimistic and excited about what's happening.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think the number go up really gets people in, and it gets people come through the door, and it gets yeah. this Trojan horse into the city. But yeah. but there's these kind of cypherpunk ideals that you explore in your documentary. You cannot separate them from the culture of Bitcoin, and sure. they're fundamental to its future as well, I'm sure.
I agree.
I had this great quote recently, and someone said that if Jesus was alive today, he would be an internet videographer, because the ability to tell kind of parables to an audience, it's the modern day kind of parable, right? And you
I
get
like
the
that
feedback.
Idea. I haven't heard that.
It's very powerful. I think in particular, this kind of short 10-minute clips, I think they're very powerful. They can have a huge audience. They can go very viral. Why did you settle on that kind of length of the projects?
Well, I mean, the project altogether is maybe about 40, 45 minutes if you add it up. Yep. I thought breaking it into a series would be a good way to, you know, because our advantage is really in our YouTube channel has a big audience, that it would be a very digestible format. And it allowed me to repeat myself a little bit. Some of these are difficult concepts, and I wanted to have the opportunity to explain them a few different times. And a series kind of allows you to do that.
Great. And so where can people begin to find a bit more out about yourself and your work?
Sure. Well, I mean, they can follow me I'm on Twitter at Jim Epstein is my handle. And then if you go to reason.com, you can find all the articles and videos I've done. And you can go to Reason TV's YouTube channel, just Reason TV, and you can subscribe and see all of our videos there. And we're also on Facebook. We put a lot of videos on Twitter, pretty much any social media platform, just see all of our work.
And this new project that you talked about, that's probably launching early kind of 2021?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yep, I think we'll have a video up around then.
Cool, great. It's nice to end with an idea of who you'd like to get into the Bitcoin space, if you could. Is there anyone you'd like to
like? Who I would love to pull into Bitcoin?
Yeah.
Oh boy. Wow. Well, I think it would be really cool if instead of building Libra, if Facebook just decided that they were going to integrate Bitcoin into WhatsApp. That'd be really cool. If Amazon started like native support for using Bitcoin, you know, these kind of like big, powerful platforms. I mean, of course, there's been some chatter. Elon Musk has been teasing interest in Bitcoin a little bit on Twitter, but you know, that would bring attention to the space. You know, all of these, I think we've seen these like well-known hedge fund investors speaking about Bitcoin, getting into Bitcoin, and that has a big impact. So I would love to see more of that kind of stuff, the kind of, you know, big titans of tech talking about and integrating Bitcoin into their projects. I think would be pretty impactful.
Great. Yeah. And so I saw just today that Zuckerberg is having another crack with the Libra version 2, slightly kind of slimmed down version. So if he gets a kickback on that one, then he's going to have to go into Bitcoin, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Well, it's been great to talk to you. And so thank you so much. We'll be putting together a page over the next couple of weeks. We'll be kind of pulling in a lot of images and the videos, obviously, from your site.
Okay, great. And I put the videos into one playlist at YouTube. I can send you that link.
Yeah, no, I've got that link. I've been using it quite a bit.
Okay.
Because it's quite frustrating when you can watch the first one and the second one hasn't popped up. You're like...
It's harder to find. Yeah, exactly.
Great. I'm really looking forward to seeing what you're going to be doing next. And I want to really get more eyes on this and educate people about the cypherpunk sort of history. I just think it's
wonderful
stuff. And so thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Take
care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Go visit another country? How lucky? Smoking baguettes, spending hella funny money? Surfing with the sharks, eating sea conchs? Snorkeling in the coral with Little Nemo shop? Splash! Didn't need to see tickets, the brochures or the pictures. You had me at visit, getting out makes me livid. Running man, moonwalk, hands been flipping. The rest of the details, I ain't even listen. Man, listen, I want your freezers missing. Next to the popsicles, really cold chilling. Eating lavender ice cream, listening to Siamese Dream. Gleaming the ice cube, put it in the iced tea. Eat all the vegetables cause you said I get an icy. You had me at Cop Killer and W.A. Booker. Two scoops of sugar, I'm shook up. Tempting bliss, add the lemon twist. Marcus, you had me at all of this. All of this.
The yellow brick road wasn't always paved yellow. It took a whole lot of bottles of limoncello, pineapple jello, shots. We should get together and connect these dots. Pop these bubbles, drop these troubles. I'm the best wingman ever, Barney Rubble. I could jump on that grenade if you need me to. Holla at a friend like come and watch some TV, boo. But had to draw the line when asked if I would sleep with you. You asking what would Jesus do? I asked what Eazy-E would do. In retrospect, I think he probably would've wrapped it up. Put a hat on first and then he would've smacked it up. You had me at 100 miles and running. Crease khakis and some Compton City Lopes, so stunning. You all about spike bats, Raider hats, dirty gats, playing craps, what's the haps? You had me at all of that. All of that.
You had me at that. You had me at 20 inch woofers in the back. You had me at that. You had me at this. You
You had me at six fours on hydraulics. You had me at this, you had me at that. You had me thinking, why must I chase the cat? You had me at that, you had me at this. I had the boom, she had the chronic.
All of it. All of it.